TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Paul Stamets, Mushrooms, Bees, and Saving the World. Paul Stamets has studied mushrooms for over 40 years. He discovered new species of fungi and saved ancient ones from extinction, and pioneered countless techniques of mushroom cultivation. Along the way, he found many ways how fungi can be healers of people and the environment. His premise is that mushroom mycelium connects the immune system between humans and the environment, and that premise has been proven many times in his collaborations with scientific institutions and labs. This is the conclusion of a one-hour speech recorded in May 2015 in Seattle, not far from Stamets' home, near Olympia, Washington. In a few minutes, you will hear about saving the honeybees. But before that, the story of the rarest mushroom in the Pacific old-growth forest, the agaricon, and how the Department of Health and Human Services Biodefense Program had to acknowledge the extraordinary healing power of that mushroom. Here is Paul Stamets.
Some of my work had focused on going into the old-growth forest and looking for particularly rare mushrooms. And I became very, very fascinated with agaricon. Agaricon, you know, it's very difficult to find. 1 out of 100 adventures into the old-growth forest, we might find them. Sometimes there's clusters and valleys, but oftentimes not. And so National Geographic gave me an award, and they want to do a story on me, on the search for agaricon, one of the rarest mushrooms in the world. So they sent a photojournalist, and we got a motor sailor with a Zodiac, and we went up the inland passage of Desolation Sound. Now he asked me, how likely is it we'd find agaricon? Well, I said, oh, 50-50. It was an optimistic, you know, response. But I had good reason, because I brought 10 of my friends with high-powered binoculars, and we wanted to find a new discovery. He didn't want us to go to a place that we'd already been. He's a writer. And so we went and we looked on the horizon. We tried to find agaricon, often where bald eagles are, or snags, and you can see this big honeycomb thing. We looked. We got retina burn after a few hours. We got burned out. He was not very happy. He goes, I'm on deadline. I go, you're from New York. Be patient. So we decided, okay, well, what the heck? You know. So our skipper said, well, let's go over to an area to have a picnic. It's a First Nations site. It's a shamanistic site. No one really knows what the pictographs mean anymore. But it's a nice place to go over. And so we went over there. As we motored over there, then Jim Gouin, one of our team leaders, goes, there's one. And we find one. And this one fell from this branch, hit this branch, and then the mushroom regenerated mycelium, connected into the tree, and then it grew 2 legs. So really, no wonder it's called Elixirium ad longum vitam. So then Scott Franzblau came with me. He's the director of the Tuberculosis Research Institute at the University of Chicago. He's been funded by the Gates Foundation. So Scott came with me because he's very interested in Dioscorides' story of agaricon being active against consumption, later to be known as tuberculosis. Well, after about 7 or 8 years, Scott and I found, along with these other colleagues, the active constituents in agaricon active against tuberculosis. We published this in the Journal of Natural Products. And the compounds are coumarins, chlorinated coumarins. These are polyphenols. Sometimes we have to go way up in trees to find agaricon. This is up on an island in British Columbia. This was the largest agaricon we've ever seen. It's about 70 years of age. Until this guy sent us a picture from NorCal, California. Typical NorCal kind of guy, right? But this one's about 100 years in age. It weighs over 150 pounds. We asked him to send us a small piece of it. He sent us a chunk like this. So we were able to get it into culture. And we don't pick these unless it's being logged or there's a fire. We GPS them. We take a small amount of tissue, and we get it into culture. Now we have 77 strains of agaricon representing thousands of hours, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of research, just to bank these in the ecosystems before the ecosystems shrink or are destroyed. Just before 9/11, I published this article in a peer-reviewed journal that was a summary of all the antiviral properties in mushrooms, a whole whopping 1 page long. That's all the scientific literature on the antiviral properties of mushrooms. Well, then 9/11 occurred, and some doctors from the BioShield Biodefense Program, the Department of Defense, that was set up after 9/11, very concerned about bioterrorism. They saw this article and said, Paul, you know, why don't you submit some of your samples, you know, to the BioShield program? And that began a long odyssey. And the selectivity index is the indication of antiviral activity. 2 is active, 10 is considered highly active. Well, we went through all this research, and it was a comedy of errors by the U.S. Defense Department. I don't want to humiliate them, but it is pretty damn funny what happened a few times. But then we got our research results. Our first 100 samples came back, and I'm going through this. I had massively high hits. I got, oh my gosh. I called up the colonel of the U.S. Defense Department saying, these results are fantastic. He goes, what results? I go, Federal Work Specialist delivered me all these lab results. He goes, you're not supposed to get those. I go, no problem. I'll photocopy them and send them to you. Which I did. But then this resulted in a vetted press release from the Department of Defense. We had the best activity of more than 2 million samples, including pharmaceuticals, from a natural product, from the mycelium, a water ethanol extract. And you can listen to a national NPR interview with myself, the deputy director of the FDA, and one of the heads of the BioShield program, saying this is really exciting. And then I was able to make the media-friendly statement, and it just came out one day, you know, this means that we should save the old-growth forest as a matter of national defense. You know, and so I'm very, very grateful to the U.S. government and the Department of Defense and all of my colleagues that have walked this path with me. I may make fun of it, but humor is always nice. So I filed a patent on this in 2003, and the patent disappeared from the patent office. 5 years later, I'm talking to my patent attorney going, where the blast is my patent? And so he called up, got a hold of the patent office, and the U.S. Defense Department took the patent out of the patent office because of biosecurity. So they took it away. And so we had to do an intergovernmental agency trace, and finally the U.S. Defense Department released it. And so that was in 2003 and 2008. And then in July this last year, the patent office awarded me a patent of a Garrikon against flu viruses and pox viruses and against herpes and also against tuberculosis, E. coli, and staph. Now that's really interesting because the majority of people that die from a flu infection die from actual bacterial pneumonia. And so your immune system's impaired, you have inflammation, all this water is being released, bacteria grow. And so to have something dually active against flu viruses and bacteria that can cause pneumonia is medically quite significant. So I gave this talk, or a talk similar to this, back in Washington, D.C., and scientists from Fort Detrick, which is, you know, our place where we have smallpox and do all this BioShield stuff, a number of the scientists came into the audience. And so they're in the audience, and then a group of Russians from Vector, that's the Fort Detrick of Russia, where they do all their top secret research, they came out with this paper, and they found that a Garrikon is highly active against flu viruses and pox viruses. It went through peer review. One of the peer reviewers go, hey, I saw Paul Stamets talk about this on his TED talk, you know, and so they had to give me credit. And so when I'm back in Washington, D.C. with an audience, and I said, you know, and we beat the Russians by 8 years, and a small cheer went up in the audience. So now the story gets very bizarre. And so we contacted NIH Virology last year. We wrote into info@nih.virology.gov, and because they said, you know, yes, you can submit more samples for antiviral testing. And we sent in the email, and 17 minutes later, the director of NIH Virology personally wrote us back saying, you're cleared. We remember you. We'd love to have more samples, but we won't do bioprospecting. You have to send us in molecules. Well, it took Scott Fransblau and I and our team 6 or 7 years to do bioguided fractionation to find out the molecule that's active against TB. And so, like, what do? I mean, there's 200,000 compounds inside these mushrooms. Which one of them? I mean, I have no idea. I was doing natural extracts. And I thought, well, there's coumarins. They're so interesting. And then I started doing more and more research. And I don't know how to explain this because it doesn't really pass the logic test. I grabbed 20 polyphenols that are associated with the delignification of wood by Garrikon. I submitted 10 of those, and these are our results. We are more active than ribavirin, acyclovir, ethylcytidine, interferon alpha, cidofovir, and falciparvir. I intuited it. These results came back from us about 2 months ago. So I was able to navigate to active molecules. We submitted them. We wrote NIH saying, you know, we beat your positive controls on our first submission. And I said, will you please retest these? Because it's hard to believe. And then they said, why? Because I said, look up the results. They looked them up. They go, oh my, this is really active. And I said, well, we want to make sure they're not false positives. And he said, they can't be false positive. We sent them to four different laboratories. So we asked them to resubmit. We got their first retest back 2 weeks ago, confirmation. So I am not religious, but I am spiritual. I believe there's a new convergence of scientists who become spiritualized by falling in love with nature and understanding the importance of the world that's given them birth. And so now I'm going to tell you some strange stories, and my life is a series of strange stories. Only you knew. So we only have 10 to 15% of the wood debris on the ground today than we did just a few hundred years ago. How is that impacting the ecosystem? 70% of soils are composed of microbial mass, and 40% of the organic mass is fungal. When you take away the wood debris, you're then taking away the menu for all these other organisms that are dependent upon the sequence of decomposition of mycelium spinning off all these nutrients. So I'm aware of this because of premature decline, 3 to 4 growths of monoculture trees in a forest, the trees topple over, the humus layer thins, you know, well aware of that. But a very weird thing happened. I was growing the garden giant mushroom, the same one that eliminates E. coli, and I had it in my garden. This is 1984, and I go out to my garden one day, and I see all these bees. And all these bees are moving the wood chips aside, and I looked at them really carefully, and I could see that they exposed the mycelium. These wood chips are like you moving a truck. I mean, they're huge compared to the bees, and they push the wood chips away to expose the mycelium, and I saw them sort of, you know, sip on the mycelium. And for 40 days, there's a convoy of bees from my two beehives to my garden, from dawn to dusk, all day long. And the bed of wood chips that was this thick got sucked down to this. I thought, this is really weird. Well, maybe they're going after the sweet sugars that the mycelium is releasing, because mycelium makes a lot of sugars. So I put this in one of my books, Growing Gourmet Medicinal Mushrooms. It was published in Harris Smith Magazine. Virtually everybody ignored me. There was a beekeeper in Ontario wrote me, says, maybe that's why bees go to sawdust piles in the summertime. I had flowering plants all over my garden. The bees preferentially went to the mycelium. So I forgot about this, more or less. And then Louis Schwarzberg is a friend of mine. He's a Disney filmmaker. And he goes, Paul, I know you're doing work with fungi and insects, but what can you do to help the bees? I go, oh, the bees. Well, yeah, Louis, I had a very strange experience. Let me look at this. Let me think about this some more. There may be something going on here. And so because of Louis questioning me, and I wanted to do something, I began to think. Well, colony collapse disorder is a euphemism. It's a media-friendly little phrase. But the bees are dying really because of the mites and lots of other cofactors that are harming the immune system of the bees. Now, President Obama came out with a presidential memorandum talking about the bees are being stressed because of poor nutrition, the forage lands are being cut down, the woods are being cut down, monoculture of plants, parasites, the mites are carrying viruses, and exposures to pesticides. Well, honeybees are heroic, but even more heroic are the native bees. Bumblebees, mason bees, 4,000 bees native to North America. The honeybee, Apis mellifera, came from Europe. Well, the other bees, the native bees, are servicing our ecosystem in ways that we can't even understand or barely imagine. But it's been said that with honeybees going into a field, a farmer's field, for instance, 80% of the pollination is coming from native bees. The honeybees are just contributing an extra 14 to 20%. So the bees are dying off. They're the proverbial canary in the coal mine. And as we rob in the carbon bank and destroy the humus and the saprophytic life cycles that are giving us all the food to all the other members in the community, we have changed the landscape in an unprecedented way. It's said 40% of our food comes directly from bees pollinating the plants, and 70% indirectly comes from bees. So looking at these ecosystems, I had other thoughts. Dusty and my wife and I are hiking the old growth forest. We spend a lot of time there, and we oftentimes see bear scratches. Well, the bear scratched the trees, and in Mason County, my neighbor killed 400 bears hired by the timber industry because bear scratching trees cause fungal infections. Well, it turns out the bears scratch the trees, and then the resin from the trees is highly attractive to bees from it getting propolis, which they use for patching their hives. And it also has antimicrobial properties. And so Dusty and I are hiking in the South Fork of the Ho River. We go around the corner, and she sees this bear scratch. And, Paul, look at this. I go, oh, my gosh. It's the best photograph of a bear scratch I've ever seen. And the bear came up the tree and went, bam, scratch it like that. I said, well, this is really interesting because the timber industry says this foamy topsis mushroom related to agaricon is that's an entry wound that causes this mushroom to infect the tree, kill the tree. The tree dies. The timber industry now doesn't have the wood to mill into lumber. So that's they have an economic incentive for killing the bears or scratching the trees. They're bringing in the polypore mushrooms. So I said, that's an interesting theory, but let's go back. And so we went back 2 years later, and after a lot of searching, because this is the middle of the old growth forest, we find the original tree with a bear scratch in it. And sure enough, that tree fell down, and we look over, and that polypore mushroom that the timber industry and the Forest Service have been talking about was indeed growing from that tree. I went, wow, that's really interesting. And then, okay, so I had that in my mind. So I had this garden giant story, you know, in my mind. I had Louis telling what can you do with the bees. I had the bear scratches. And then I'm a voracious reader of scientific literature. And then this article came out, and it turned out that the bees that suffer from colony collapse, now bear in mind, what happens is the bees leave and they don't come back. And there are nurse bees taking care of the brood, but when the worker bees go out, the foraging bees, when they're flapping, you see bees around flowers at the end of their life. They flap their wings until they're shredded. They're bringing back pollen to the hive, but they're at the very end of their life. But when they don't come back, the nurse bees then are prematurely recruited to become foraging bees to replace the workers that didn't come back. So eventually you have the nurse bees abandoning the hive. As a result, the mites there that would otherwise be mitigated by the nurse bees and other factors, they're there injecting viruses into the young bees. And so then this article came out saying, oh my, that they looked at the honey in these hives where the bees had been abandoned, and it's lacking an interesting coumarin, p-cumaric acid. I said, wow, that's interesting. Scott and I were talking about coumarins with the anti-tubercular properties. And it turns out that p-cumaric acid upregulates the cytochrome P450 pathway. All animals use it. You have it mostly in your liver. It breaks down toxins. And bees only have 47 of these genes. Humans have 60. Most insects have 80. And it turns out that the lack of these fungally produced coumarins turns off the detoxification pathways in the bees. And now the neonicotinoids, the glyphosates, all these pesticides and herbicides are hyperaccumulating in the bees, causing them to have malaise, impairing their immune system. Mites are biting them, and now viruses are proliferating out of control. And so it's a perfect storm. So then another article came out, and it turned out that sublethal doses of these insecticides, which were only studied one at a time by the EPA, but not in combination, then has a dramatically negative effect on bee survival. And then another article came out that's showing the use of fungicides around these fields defeat the fungi that then don't have the p-cumeric acid compounds giving to the bees, so their detoxification pathways are not turned on. So all these things coming together, and I'm thinking, wow, I think I can do something about this. And so most commercial honey beekeepers use sugar water, and they put it into to supplement to help to replace the honey that they're taking and also help the bees to be healthy as a food source. It's 50% water, 50% sugar. So I thought, well, okay, if I can get these coumarins being produced, and some of these mushrooms have antiviral properties, maybe we should start working to come up with something that can help the bees. So David Summerlin and my other teammates and myself, we created Myco Honey. This is mycelium-based only. There's no added sugar. This is a mycelial hunting material. We got real excited about this. I contacted several universities, and when I went to Steve Shepard at Washington State University, he said, stop, don't go anywhere else. And so then we set up a series of experiments at WSU and started feeding the bees the mycelial extracts, the mycohoney. And so we started playing around, and then the results came back on a stress test for longevity as well as antiviral activity. And this gets very strange. It turns out bees are attracted to young fir trees, scratches, and birch trees and other species in the Populaceae that are related, like poplars and willow trees. And we found that the red-belted polypore, the same one the bear scratches the trees and the mushroom comes out, that's the one, the red-belted polypore, chaga, which we found with the BioShield program, is strongly antiviral against flu viruses, also against other viruses, and amadou, the mushroom, which is the first source of an antiviral against the tobacco mosaic virus, and reishi mushrooms turn out to be extremely beneficial to the bees. And Dr. Steve Shepard, with 39 years of experience studying bees, he's never seen anything like this, where the longevity of the bees was increased. And this difference here is huge, because this means that the foraging bees can go out and do their job at the time when the colony is most dependent upon them. Then we looked at the red-belted polypore. We found that different concentrations then would extend the life of the bees significantly. So as we diluted the extracts, they became more potent for the bees. This is wonderful from a production point of view because we just add water. So we found that, wow, the red-belted polypore and chaga extends the livelihood of bees. So then we started looking at bee viruses, and the bee viruses in the control from 1 week to the next week, the viruses, skyrocket. And then on a dose-dependent basis with the chaga extract, the viruses then would decline as we increase the concentration. So we had increase in longevity and we had decrease in viruses. And so then we looked at the antiviral properties of the red reishi mushroom that also grows on birch trees. Similar situation. The virus controls go up, and then as you increase the concentration of the extract, the viruses plummet. And it is thought that the mites carrying the viruses really do the bees in. So the summary of this is that with the controls, the viruses increase dramatically. With these extracts, the viruses then plummet. So now this is so strange because we all grew up with Winnie the Pooh. We all knew that bears would go into logs to get honey from bees' nests. I've given several talks to huge audiences, the North American Mycological Association, the American Bee Association, and I asked them, has anyone here ever heard of bees being attracted to mycelium? Anywhere in the scientific literature? Any public talk? No one. Hiding in plain sight. We don't know the way of the bee, and the bees are attracted, I believe, to logs for immunological benefit, not only getting the sugars, but getting the upregulating compounds that cause the detoxification pathways. You have the antiviral properties. So we started reimagining, well, maybe we could reinvent the beehive. And would make the beehive made of mycelium, because all beehives after about 5 years have to be replaced. They get black molds. Those are also toxic to bees. What if the beehives, as they mature, actually then the mycelium grows, and it helps the bees' immunity and helps their longevity. And so there's so many things that I think that we can possibly do. So in summary, humans, trees, bears, mushrooms, all terrestrial organisms are interconnected within the mycelial web of life. Now think of the implications of this. Chaga, reishi, some of the other mushrooms that I mentioned are active against viruses that harm humans, H1N1. Oh, H1N1 harms pigs. H5N1 is bird flu. The same mushrooms are active against viruses that harm humans, birds, pigs, bats carrying Ebola, and bees. This could be a fundamental breakthrough and understanding something foundational about the ecosystems that have given us life. That the mycelium in the ecosystem is controlling the immunological health of the inhabitants that walk upon this mycelial mats. And if this is true, which I think it is, This also speaks to the fact when a carrying organism exceeds the carrying capacity of his ecosystem, diseases proliferate, knocks down the virulent organism. And I think this thing speaks to where we need to really focus as we go into the future, understanding that we are all interconnected. We live within these mycelial membranes. We live in these networks of information, networks of immunity, networks of food, and our food security is so dependent upon these other organisms, but we are so blind. And it's not surprising that some of these mushrooms are more familiar to scientists. Many of these mushrooms are so perishable, they disappear in 5 days. When you have mushrooms that can feed you, that can kill you, that can make you high, that can heal you, and it's only in your visual viewscape for a few days, you know, that compare that to animals and plants that you were in a viewscape for months, years. And so it's naturally for humans to avoid that which is powerful, but that it's mysterious to them. But we have come to a threshold of knowledge now that I think all of us can participate in helping bees by engaging in decomposition cycles of wood. Don't export it. Let it sit on the ground. Let it rot. And maybe we should all become a lot more bee mushroomed. And scientists should work across disciplines, because biodiversity is our biosecurity. And I believe habitats have immune systems, and mycelial networks are the cellular bridges that connect us all. Thank you very much, folks.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour talk by Paul Stamets. He has studied mushrooms for over 40 years, discovered new species, and saved others from extinction. Stamets is the founder of Fungi Perfecti at www.fungi.com. FUNGI.com is a family-owned company specializing in mushroom cultivation and research. Much of the financial resources generated from Fungi Perfecti sales are used to preserve and protect ancestral strains of mushrooms from the endangered old-growth forests of the Pacific Northwest. Stamets is the author of many books, among them Mycelium Running, a manual for the mycological rescue of the planet. He was recorded by Mike McCormick on May 4, 2015 in Seattle, Washington. Mike is host of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Radio. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.